All right, hello everyone. I am here with Timothy. Timothy, would you like to say hello so they can hear you?
Greetings.
Okay, you guys can hear Timothy, okay? Is that true? Did you hear his one word? Yes, okay, they heard your
Namaste.
One word. Yeah, just so you guys know, Timothy is on Skype with me, and then I'm bringing him into the room on my microphone. Now, this next bit of information is for Timothy and everyone in the room. I am working on a Mac, and my Skype is on the Mac side, but my PalTalk, where all of you are, is on the Windows side. I actually have Windows running on my Mac. And so what I can do is swipe back and forth. Of course, Timothy has turned off his video, so I'll just be swiping over it, I guess, every now and then, check and make sure everything looks good in Skype. And then I can swipe back over to PalTalk to see what's happening here. But occasionally, if you put up your hand or type a comment, I might not see it right away because I might be over on the Mac side with Timothy. But the sound works no matter where I swipe back and forth. So you can always hear, but I just may not always see you. Also, I just want to say thank you to everyone for coming this evening in order to get to know Timothy along with me. This is my first time really talking with Timothy, other than last week when I called him quickly because I had accidentally told him the wrong date. I called him to tell him I made a mistake.
We are the timeless. Yeah. Sometimes rigging this little affair called time gets a little complicated.
Yeah. So other than that, we haven't talked yet. So this will be, he is new for me as well as all of you. But we did ask Timothy to be one of our speakers at the Awakening Together Satsang that's coming up in September in Santa Barbara. And the reason for that was a heart feeling. We called up a friend of ours named Rick, who does the Buddha at the gas pump, and asked him who he recommended. And he recommended a few people. And we went and watched the videos he had of these people. And, you know, it felt really good about Timothy. But then I think, Timothy, just so you know, when yeah. I really fell in love with you was when I emailed you because of your very sweet, sweet response. And you've always been very, very sweet in your emails. And, of course, last week when I made the mistake, you were very, very sweet. And, you know, for me, when someone is very rude to me, it makes me question whether the love of clarity that I know is truly present. And your sweetness just kind of won me over, so.
Oh, bless your heart, my dear.
Not that you aren't allowed to be direct, because I understand that directness comes through too. But, yeah.
Yeah, an old Indian expression is our true nature is hard as a diamond and soft as a flower.
Yeah. So, yeah.
We have all capacities.
Yeah.
They flow forth.
Absolutely. I understand that because I watch myself. So I understand. Well, why don't we start, Timothy? I don't want to spend the whole time talking about your personal experience of awakening, but because
we don't need that.
No, but just because this is an introduction and they don't know you from Adam, maybe if we could just give them a little bit of your story, just to give some context, whatever you feel to tell, and whatever details you want to leave out is also fine, but just to kind of introduce yourself.
Well, your sighting of Rick Archer, who does the Buddha at the gas pump, Rick finally teased that whole long story out of me, and some of it's up at a biography section about Timothy at this huge website we've had up since around 2006, enlightened-spirituality.org. So people can look up some of the prosaic details there. Well, this Timothy fellow was just a very ordinary young little lad, totally interested in sports. Sports was my religion growing up. And along about the age of 16, a series of knee injuries made it pretty clear I had no future in athletics. I had a big knee surgery at age 15. They did all sorts of monstrous stuff, like putting in a 2-inch stainless steel screw. So I knew athletics was finished for me, and that was my whole world. So bereft of that, there was a real kind of existential crisis, not helped by the fact that at our Jesuit high school I went to, I grew up as a Catholic kid, they had us reading the French existentialists like Camus and Sartre and other European existentialists who have a very bleak outlook, a very absurdist sense of the cosmos. And I fell in with that. The situational depression crept in. I actually felt suicidal for a short time. I was having horrible nightmares night after night. And then one day, out of the blue, everything just opened up, and a massive sudden shift happened out in the backyard while I was just doing some calisthenics. Being an athletic kid, I did calisthenics all the time, so it was nothing going on physiologically any different. But suddenly, I just knew that we are all made of divine love, light, kindness, sweetness, the divine power that's spinning the galaxies and vibrating the molecules and atoms and subatomic mystery. I knew that we are made of this one reality, that everyone is this reality, that this one reality is doing everything and being everyone as our true self. So, it's not a personal story about Timothy. It's a story about grace, the grace of the reality that we all are. And so, you know, it's kind of useless talking much about Timothy's personal story, because everyone's personal story, insofar as stories go for the personal consciousness, the viewpoint, as I like to refer to it, how does this one reality come up with all these gazillion different viewpoints, different beings, different persons or souls or jivas, as they call them in India? So this to me is a stunning miracle. And it was clear to me that everyone has this intrinsic connection with this source reality, the substance of everyone, the witness of everything, the destiny of everyone, the one shapeless, colorless power that's doing everything, without which we can't comprehend language, make sense of vision or hearing or sensing. We can't get up and walk across a room or lift a finger, blink an eye. There's some power, again, mysterious, shapeless, colorless. You can't make an object out of it. And this power is dreaming this whole incredible divine dream of all these beings and all these worlds. So that was just suddenly absolutely clear to me. And it was a wordless thing. I'd not been reading any spiritual texts or anything like that. Again, I was a dumb jock, just a state of situational depression. So it was a sudden awakening, and it made a huge difference. Everyone noticed it. My parents and even my younger sister, who was smoking a lot of pot, I never touched any hallucinogens. They all thought I was on drugs. Because I would look at people and just be absolutely full of wonder that the one reality can come up as the Regina point of view, or my mother or sister or dad's point of view, or my buddies at school. Little bugs. I used to keep a magnifying glass in my desk, because sometimes, especially in the spring and summer and fall, little bugs would work their way in around the screen or something. They'd be on my study desk where I, you know, do my homework for school. And I'd love to get out the magnifying glass and just have mutual darshan, sight of the beloved, the divine, just gazing at, you know, some little moth or some little flying creature. Because it was clear to me that one self of all selves is playing as each of these personal consciousnesses, human consciousnesses, animal consciousnesses, including bugs, celestial beings. So, you know, very quickly I realized that you can't just go around in this totally awestruck mode of sensing the one reality alone. Now, all the women would see me of all ages. They thought I was trying to come on to them. All the guys thought I was gay because I was looking at everyone so deeply. It was just an absolute epiphany, a divine revelation that this one reality, utterly transcendent and yet fully here, imminent, pervading each and every one, every situation, every world, is playing as everyone you meet. So I felt that I didn't need to see a God up in a heaven or go to some heaven in some other kind of subtle realm. No, it was clear to me that this realm right now, immediately, prior to any planning or strategizing or spiritual practices, immediately here, now, divine truth. And it's utterly formless, and yet this truth is forming as all formations, all worlds, all beings. So there was like nothing to do other than to just know this. This one power, shapeless, colorless, this one truth, this self of all selves, this life of all lives. And so everything shifted from being all wrong. You know, I was in kind of a suicidal state before that, to being everything is all right. And in fact, to this day, the satsangs I've shared over the many years, I always open them and close them with just the simple word, all right.
You know, I happened to go to the movies today, and I saw the movie called Heaven is for Real, or Heaven is Real, I think it's called, about the little boy who somehow had an experience of what you called a subtle realm of heaven. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that movie, you know, I think creates some conflict for some people, but for me, it did not create any conflict because I wasn't considering the idea of whether there is or is not a physical heaven. It doesn't matter. What I picked up on was the subtle messages he received through that experience.
Yeah.
And the primary subtle message I saw him receive was, the way he worded it is, no one will ever hurt us.
Yeah.
You know, he's a little boy. He says, no one will ever hurt us. That was his message. Right. And there's nothing to be afraid of. And it was just so very, very cute. Now, we had a...
That also suggests, if I could just...
Oh, you know, please do.
Quick, you know, the original non-dual revelation to this planet, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the oldest of the Upanishads, along with the Chandogya Upanishad, the biggest Upanishads, that slightly eldest one, the Brihadaranyaka, it has a line in there. There where there is the sense of an other, there is the root of fear.
Mm.
When we intuitively, fully, completely know that one reality is here doing everything, being everyone, playing all the parts, all the action sequences, then we can stand as the fearless principle, because there is no other in our absolute nature. Relatively, on the, say, human level, there is a functional sense of fear, like, you know, a wild predator animal leaps out of the shrubs while you're taking an evening jog or something. There's old programming to, you know, have a stress response get triggered, the fight, flight, or freeze response of the sympathetic nervous system, a lot of cortisol and adrenaline rush through the bloodstream, and the organs get pumped for either fighting back or running away, or maybe sitting down and doing Gandhi-style meditation with the predator animal, and the predator might get it. To meditate with you. Otherwise, you wind up being that predator's dinner.
Yeah.
Early breakfast, whatever. So, but on the deep level, we can stand as fearlessness, even if the body was being gobbled up by the mountain lion or, you know, the coyote. We've got them right here in our yard often, up here in the hills of Santa Barbara. You know, on the absolute level, there's this sense of, one reality, you know, playing as the coyote, playing as the Timothy body, which is now food for the coyote, or pack of them. They travel in packs. So on the deep level, there can be fearlessness. Well, on the human level, there might be, you know, a triggering of the sympathetic nervous system, that stress response. Anyway, I interrupted you.
No, you can't interrupt me. Don't worry about it. That's impossible. I don't actually believe in interruption. I think that there's a natural flow of conversation, and sometimes it has that appearance of interruption, but it's what was supposed to happen. So
you are seamless wholeness, uninterruptible.
Yeah. And had I not wanted to listen, I could have interrupted you a number of times because there were so many things that you were triggering in my mind to say, but I was just quiet and listened. But first of all, just to let you know, I didn't prepare for this. I never prepare for anything. I feel better if I don't. I feel better if everything is purely spontaneous. And one of the things you just talked about was as you were talking about fear, fearlessness, and then that, you know, we could call it that physical fear, like if a mountain lion was about to pounce on me. You mentioned I'm going to call it two eyes, for lack of a better word right now. You mentioned the eye that is fearless, and then the human eye that somehow is still there that might be afraid, might react to the mountain lion. Could you talk a little bit about your experience, both of the fearless eye and then still of being human? What is that like to have the experience of both simultaneously, or do you? Am I wrong?
Well, you know, the way our divine reality plays this play, it is suprapersonal. It's not impersonal. That's a word that gets used too often in different spiritual circles. And the impersonal is like, you know, hydrogen and helium clouds or the tarmac in the parking lot or on the roadway surface. That's impersonal, inanimate. And then we have, obviously, the personal realm of not just human persons, but animal persons and subtle plane persons. You might have encounters with so-called departed relatives or, you know, spiritual teachers. Ramana Maharshi appears in your dreams, or whomever, Jesus. Happy Easter to everyone who's celebrating this. The unarisen Lord, risen, unarisen, unborn, undying. Anyway, the suprapersonal reality that we truly are is not merely personal and certainly not impersonal. The suprapersonal reality is prior to all persons, the source of all persons, what is animating all persons. This is the real sentience. So-called sentient beings don't actually have their own sentience. We don't have any power at all. This Timothy personal consciousness has no clue how it grew that little fertilized egg cell in mama's womb up to, you know, what, an 8.5-pound baby and now a 6-foot-4 tall male human being. I have no idea how to grow hair or digest food. It happens by the power of this suprapersonal power. So our true nature, our unborn, original nature, and fundamental right now, our real truth, is this superpersonal, open awareness. You can't make an object out of this, a thing out of this. It's not an entity, it's absolute. This, right here, immediate, closer than your eyeballs, nearer than breathing. It's what you are prior to even thinking about spirituality or practicing anything on the phenomenal, empirical, personal consciousness level. So we have this suprapersonal awareness, isness, aliveness, this open capacity for experiencing all the worlds and all the different beings, the different viewpoints or persons. And we have this unique individual personal consciousness. The Regina personal consciousness has its own memories and capacities, skills, talents, relationships. The Timothy configuration of this viewpoint related with its cluster of memories and traits and cognitive and temperamental tendencies and so forth is somehow mysteriously distinct and different from the Regina viewpoint or the Barack Obama viewpoint or John Boehner or a little bug or a baboon or some kind of space being in some other world. It's just miraculous that this one superpersonal reality can come up with, can dream up these viewpoints and play as this apparently limited, finite, personal, individual viewpoint. And so this personal consciousness is what has all the, to use a technical term from ancient Hindu Vedanta and Buddhism, the samskaras or vasanas, these personal tendencies. These, some are wholesome, like you might have a capacity, a talent for music or dance, statesmanship, womanship, business leadership. That's a particular wholesome kind of samskara, leadership quality, a quality for bringing excellence, an artistic capacity, whatever, being a good parent, grandparent. That's a talent. Being a good community organizer, for instance, a good gardener. These are wholesome samskaras or vasanas, but the ones that the traditions, spiritual traditions, refer to are the ones that are the more complicating, the ones that bring up these emotionally charged reactive patterns, the so-called unwholesome states of, you know, unwholesome kinds of anger, greed, seediness, pettiness. So being the absolute, the superpersonal, the open awareness, we are witness to and source for this remarkable, absolutely marvelous play of the personal consciousness with all of its foibles and its fantastic, beautiful qualities. It's an amazing dream being played out here in the realm of manifestation, when our unmanifest, open, non-objective, purely spiritual awareness nature is hosting this. So one will often find oneself in a situation where the personal consciousness isn't just a functional tool, you know, for communicating with fellow beings, working in a computer, holding down a job, paying bills, raising a family, managing a household or a corporation or an ashram or whatever it might be. No, the personal consciousness will also have times where it's being triggered. Old samskara or vasana patterns are being tested. It's like how loving and clear and patient, equanimous, you know, peaceful can you be when this is happening? Ooh, how about when this is happening? Or this?
All right.
Concentration camp, or your child is suddenly, you know, stricken with some horrible condition. Politically, something's going on that just is nauseating and sickening for what it means for the commonweal, the public good, the welfare of all beings. You know, like the recent Supreme Court decision, you know, certain members of that court, we know what their ideology is, and their ideology is business and wealth comes first. That rules America. So when one hears about that, there's naturally a response, a sense of anguish for what that will literally mean in terms of suffering for sentient beings. So I mentioned earlier, the only real sentience is the absolute, the one divine awareness. Through the power of this universal consciousness, or Om, or Logos, the divine word, as it's called at the beginning of the John Gospel in Christianity, this vibrational power to dream forth a divine dream cosmos of all these worlds and beings and relationships, this one absolute dreams up a universal consciousness principle, the Om for short, the seed vibration. And then this gives rise to all these differentiated worlds and beings and happenings. And then each of these personal consciousnesses, they don't have their own sentience, but by the power of this one divine power, they seem to have the Regina experience of the Regina body and mind and emotions will seem so vivid. The Timothy experience of the body, mind will seem so vivid, but what is the source of this experience? It's not Regina or Timothy or any being. It's what's their true host. So there is a very curious kind of simultaneity. It's a real paradox. Your divine nature plays at being not divine. The absolute plays at being this relative set of processes. The infinite, unlimited, plays as being this finite, limited perspective, with strong sensations, perceptions, emotions, and the sense of the personal consciousness. I just named, incidentally, the four of the five mental aspects of the old five skandhas, pancha skandhas in Sanskrit, or pancha khandhas in Buddhist Pali language. The Buddha basically said our personality is fivefold. It's the rupa, the physical form or materiality. And beyond this physical plane, say subtle beings, they have a subtle plane form, or rupa. And then out of this basic physical energetic form arises these sensations, these raw, powerful sensations of seeing, hearing, outer touch, inner touch, tasting, smelling, And then out of these sensations, perceptions arise as a way of making sense out of sensations. Like, we're not just dazzled by all the sensations. We know, oh, that object over there is a chair. Oh, that's a blue shirt. That's a green shirt. Oh, that's a particular kind of plant, that shrub or tree outside the window. Now, that's where perception comes in, where we can recognize each other, use language, use tools, design new tools like cell phones and software programs and so forth, be humorous, come up with jokes. All that's on the level of perception, and it also involves memory, planning, anticipation, comparison, evaluation. And then that will trigger, depending on what's arising in the formations, emotional responses, and they create an inherent kind of volitional pattern to do something with what is triggering the emotion, be it pleasurable, painful, or neutral. And then finally, the fifth of the five skandhas, or khandhas, to use the old Buddhist Pali, is a sense of the personal consciousness, a sense of a me to whom all of this is happening. And in an unwholesome way, this me will take on a sense of pride and hubris, arrogance, and think that it somehow owns the whole process, that I'm in charge of my life. I can be a co-creator with God. When in fact, again, I don't know how to generate a single enzyme in my gut to digest the food that went down the mouth. So there's this simultaneous sense that you are the one power alone. There is only this one power, shapeless, formless, infinite, and yet capable of manifesting these finite processes. And simultaneously, you're this little Timothy person, or the Regina person, or again, a little bug, or a bird flying by, singing on a tree branch. And each personal consciousness has this rich, rich empirical world filled with bodily energies, sensations, perceptions, emotional responses, and then a sense of the personal consciousness. But none of this is who we are. Absolutely. It's what we are relatively as part of the dream play, the great divine stage play of the one actor playing each of the roles, each of the parts. So our true nature, said the Buddha, when he would run off for his listeners, male and female, 2,500 years ago, he would run off the five personality components, bodily form, sensation, perception, samskaras or emotional reaction, and then the personal consciousness, the vijnana in ancient Pali and Sanskrit. He would then say, and this is like, I think, the most common refrain in the entire Pali canon of earliest authentic Buddhist teaching, the Buddha would say, Netammama ne sohamasmi na me sovata. Netammama, this is not me. Ne sohamasmi, this is not the I, who I am. And the final Pali phrase means, this is not myself. And elsewhere he talks about our real self as this unborn, unbecome, uncompounded and unmade reality prior to all the dimensions, where the sun does not shine, the moon does not shine. In other words, it's a way of describing this clear light of awareness, which is not a luminous object, but the capacity to see all lights, all lit up worlds, all beings, all situations. Just to make this real for people in their empirical experiencing, when you dream at night, what lights up your dream world? You don't need a sun or LED lights or incandescent lights. What's lighting up your dream world? It's consciousness itself lights up the world and all the beings you interact with in this field of and play of consciousness. Consciousness itself is not a luminous object. It's the clear light, as the Tibetan Buddhists call it, the source by which all other lesser lights and beings and worlds are known. That's why, again, our most ancient wisdom text, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, about 2,800 years ago, it seems to have come into being, and it said, our true nature, the Parabrahman or Paramatman, the Self Supreme, self of all selves, as I like to say. Because this is not impersonal, this is suprapersonal. Not merely personal, certainly not merely impersonal, but suprapersonal. The suprapersonal self is the light by which we see the light of the sun, the light of the moon, the light of the fire, the fireflies. This is what we are, this clear light, open awareness. And people get stuck or confused spiritually because they're still seeking some kind of subtle object. They think self-realization is coming upon some kind of special terrain, some new set of dimensions, some new feeling, some mode by which they will be relieved of troubles, sorrow, confusion, and restlessness. But this is a myth. The self is always already our truth, everyone's truth, despite what the personal consciousness is going through with its skanda reactions and perceptions and sensations and physical energies.
Now, Timothy, you had a spontaneous awakening experience when you were quite young. You were a teenager.
16.
Yeah, and most of the people that are in the room now, you know, as I scan and I see who's here, we're talking, well, we do have one very young person that's just turned 18, but the majority of the people are 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and have not yet had an experience of a shift like you experienced. And probably it would be fair to say this shift is something that they desire. And I think that
that's a normal yearning.
Yes.
Our own divinity seeks out divine realization.
Well, and I think that probably one common, at least talked about practice, I can't say for sure whether everybody here practices it or not, but one common talked about practice is what I tend to call purification, but it's the practice of noticing those habits and of the mind, thoughts in the mind, what triggers me. Looking at it, learning to watch it instead of being triggered. And like my personal experience over a number of years has been that there are less and less things that trigger. There's just more and more natural joy, happiness, peace. Still not a shift, though. I would say, to be fair, I still feel identified with Regina, although I don't know if she's as important as she used to be.
She's absolutely important.
Well, by
disintegrate.
Well, by that I mean I'm not all worried about her. You know, her and her life, and you know whether things are going her way or not. That's not important. I like to just let things be as they are now, and kind of watch the show. But my question was,
and if I could say, that's that natural at ease equanimity, which all the great sages and texts are talking about.
Yes. Yes, and I think that's at least been my practice, even though I didn't have that word until the last year, but that has been my practice, has been achieving that equanimity through what I would call a serious inner focused work. So that leads up to my question.
Sure.
You had your shift at a very young age. Now, did a lot of these things that like I'm talking about clearing away that trigger me, did a lot of these things just fall away for you? Or were they all still there, and was there a working through them process that happened after your shift?
So much really did fall off, all sorts of needless fears. I was a painfully shy kid, you know, in my youth. I could talk up a storm when I was talking about sports, or, you know, with my buddies about Mickey Mantle and the New York Yankees, or Bart Starr and the Green Bay Packers football team, or Jerry West and the LA Lakers. I could talk up a storm, but generally I was kind of a shy kid, and there were a lot of fears, hesitancies, uncertainties, and a massive amount of that, I could say, just instantly fell off, as well as, you know, the kind of emotional pity party. A little self-pity party, that just evaporates. Because you know that divine bliss is everyone's real nature. It's what's powering the whole cosmos. It's a whole play of ecstatic love. And the most amazing, miraculous energy is giving rise to the pads on your fingertips and your toes, let alone all the dozens of organ systems and usually on average about 70 trillion cells in the body. They're just dancing with divine bliss. Otherwise, they'd all just be utterly dead and inert. This one power is vibrating and animating everything. So much drops off in this kind of shift. But let me say that the shift, you know, I've looked at the Enlightenment literature around the world since I was 16. I made that a specialty to read everything I could so that no one else would have to go through all of it. And I wrote master's thesis and doctoral dissertation about all that stuff. I've got a huge 2-volume work on the non-dual traditions of India in the works. And more recently, I decided to interrupt it and take 2 years of that. I'm nearly finished with a big kind of source book encyclopedia on the Chan and Zen tradition. So I know what these sages are talking about. I did specialty coursework in Christian mysticism, Jewish mysticism, and the Sufi mystics of Islam. I know what these sages and the texts are saying. I'll tell you this. What gets described for different beings is sometimes a very dramatic, sudden shift, like what happened to this Timothy character when I was 16. I just woke him up from being this self-absorbed nitwit to just being totally in love with everyone and life as the manifestation of the unmanifest divine. But for many beings, there will be a dawning. It's like when the sun comes up in the east in the morning. If you're out there pre-dawn, you see that it's dark, and then it starts getting faintly, faintly, faintly lighter.
Yeah.
And then a little more lit up, but it's still kind of dark. But then that dim light is not quite so dim, and then finally it's getting brighter. And then this sun, my God, amazing sun, the sun god Ra, this self-luminous orb, massive nuclear energies and power rises up in the east. And suddenly this, you know, the whole environment is lit up. You see things you couldn't see in the pre-dawn dim light. And then finally that sun is rising up, and then it's at its zenith, and it's a bright day, just, you know, the warmth of everything, full-blown luminosity for your environment. In the same way, many beings will undergo what in Chan and Zen they called sudden enlightenment, but it's worth nothing unless there's the gradual cultivation after that. There's a phrase in Chan and Zen, in Korean Song Buddhism, that's Korean Zen, sudden enlightenment, gradual cultivation. Now, how this differs from the normal sense of spiritual aspiration and unfolding for people is that with this sudden enlightenment, you awaken to your intrinsic no-thingness, your vast, open, void-like, and yet full of awareness, full of intelligence, full of isness, full of this aliveness. There can be an instant awakening to this, the primal principle, what you truly are, before you can even think about being a someone who's interested in God realization or purification or, you know, becoming a holy being. Prior to all those thoughts, you are this thought-free, world-free, person-free, in the sense of being the supra-personal, openness. So anyone can intuitively awaken into and as this, because this is our real nature. Our divine nature knows that it is divine. Awareness, pure, simple, infinite, knows that this is the awareness, giving rise to all energies, sensations, perceptions, knowings, feelings. So anyone can awaken right now, and the path or secret to this pathless path, this journey from here to here, as Meher Baba called it about 50 years ago, is simply willing to be no body, no thing, not any kind of thing. Trusting, having this implicit divine faith in your own divine nature as not like a human being, not like a personal consciousness. With this sudden awakening to our host nature, this open, no-thing-like, void-like, full of awareness, full of isness, nature, then the whole life, the Regina life, the Timothy life, the John or Susie or Fred or Georgina life is set up, or shall I say freed, to simply unfold without the burden of a sense of a me that has to do its own spirituality, that has to measure up, that has to avoid all these terrible pitfalls and mistakes and sins and flaws, that has to be yogic and, you know, have a perfectly quiet mind. Have you ever noticed now the teachers say, I want you to have a perfectly quiet liver? The teachers that are telling you to come on these retreats, you must have a quiet mind, have some of the busiest minds I've ever heard buzzing. They're always buzzing with greed. How can we separate more people from more money? Yeah. Than this yogi and others, you know, trying to come up with $10,000 a person initiation schemes and so forth. So you don't need any of that. It's to simply stand as what you are, as open, infinite, no-thing-like, source of all things, host nature, and then see how the life, the Timothy life or whatever life, plays out. Notice its reactions. You spoke, Regina, about how it was a real focused process, a period of really seeing, noticing, sensing what was going on. And that is your own divine nature's way of seeing off what you don't need anymore. The extraneous elements of a life that aren't really essential or fundamental. In Zen, they have a marvelous saying, don't add legs to a snake. And so much of our functioning has this added dysfunction, this layer of tension, worry, hatred toward other people, competitiveness with other people, whatever it might be, ruthless, greedy ambition, pettiness, and so forth. We simply don't need that. It's just much ado about nothing. So what is it to just be and see that we are free?
Yeah.
Intrinsically. And then as my teacher, my mentor over in India, the great, great wisdom sage Nisargadatta Maharaj, I get to spend very intense quality time with him, about 10 days, 8 months before he dropped the body. And people would, you know, talk about, well, what happens after enlightenment? He would dismiss the questions and say, wake up to what you are and then see what happens. A personal set of functions, you know, a functional personality will arise to zestfully, as he said, serve and love and your fellow beings. There will be great kindness and love and power, but it won't be you, the personal consciousness, pushing and moving all of this. No, you'll be surrendered unto the one power, the power by which we can't even lift a finger without this power. So any of your dear friends listening in tonight, my new friends, you're all bodiless and formless. Your energies for me right now just permeating the space interdimensionally. What you are is not a human being. You are this entirely spiritual reality. Spiritual reality, the divine, the absolute, playing as this particular person, this other particular beautiful, poignant, precious person, this other person. And these persons will eventually wake up, not through their own power, but by the power of this intrinsic divine nature, the divine that awakens all persons to the superpersonal. I can tell you that your awakening on the personal consciousness level, your enlightenment, is guaranteed because there is only this divine reality. An ancient Indian scripture about 2,200 years ago, the Brahma Sutra or Vedanta Sutra, it was a summation of the earlier Upanishads. It said, all will become Brahman, divine reality, because there is only Brahman. Well, if you will, in Western tradition, this is the great early widespread Christian mystical teaching of apokatastasis, universal salvation, or liberation, or redemption, that divine love, divine truth is all powerful and will eventually, sooner or later, awaken all beings, even Satan, to this divine reality. All needless tendencies of hatred, fear, anger, resentment, bitterness, pettiness, all that will get melted, evaporated. It's not really real right now as any kind of thing or entity, the ego and its material. It's a dream. It's clouds forming and transforming and unforming in a vast, clear, spacious sky. This is what you are right now. So, know this and be free. The truth shall set you free. What it does is your intrinsic nature is always already free. So the liberation is paradoxical. The personal consciousness gets liberated from the unnecessary. This layer of dysfunctional reaction patterns and so forth, unneeded, narrow, selfish kind of perceptions, that just evaporates, and what's left is a highly functional personality, and then the power to function comes from the divine power. Again, the same power that's growing hair, digesting food, when you have a cut, a scratch on your skin, what heals that up? You don't do it. I mean, you might think you're helping by, I don't know, putting disinfectant on it and a bandage, but what's actually de-differentiating the cells and then regrowing new cells, including hair follicle cells and hair cells and, you know, upper level of the epidermis and lower levels, what's doing all that? It's miraculous. You, the personal consciousness, have nothing to do with it. Yet it happens. The superpersonal is doing all. So let everyone just relax, be at ease. Melt back into your vastness. You've always been this open, ever free, always at peace, truly blissful awareness. This is your true nature. It's everyone's true nature. So there can be a relaxing, a laughing, a gentle, at ease, yielding, allowing, flowing as this formlessness that can form, this divinity that can play at being a human or any kind of being. Trust this. So anyone can suddenly awaken to this, and then the rest of the life is the gradual cultivation of various skills, talents, virtues, helpful qualities. You learn to be a better friend to your friends, a better spouse to your spouse, a parent to your children.
Or your parents, if they're old enough.
A better adult child to your parents. Sure, or your neighbors. Being a better neighbor, or a better citizen.
Yeah, Timothy, that's one thing that might be a little different about you than some of the spiritual teachers in the non-dual community. And again, I really haven't I've spent some time on your website, but I'm not a Timothy expert by any stretch of the imagination. But I have picked up on some little differences. And one of those little differences seems to be what I'm going to call your concern for others. For instance, I know that you said on Sunday morning you go and serve, I believe, in a soup kitchen. You serve breakfast to the homeless. And, you know, lots of people, you know, call this world an illusion. And, you know, it's almost like they have a judgment against that type of helping. Can you speak about this a little bit?
Yeah, I'll simply say, you know, I wrote an award-winning essay back in 1983 in grad school called This Is All a Dream. The culmination, because, you know, that's a statement that's found in all our sacred traditions, East and West. Different sages have affirmed that. Maybe not every sage put it in just those words, but, you know, they might speak of the world as an illusion or, you know, a mirage, a bit of magic trick, magician's trick, as the Buddha calls this, but he also openly calls it a dream. So here's the wisdom about this. The whole manifest set of realms all beings, all their experiences, is just a dream. And wow, what a dream. As the Buddha taught, wisdom deconstructs all of this. Sees that nothing is what it seems. There is no thingness anywhere. I mean, Werner Heisenberg, one of the quantum mechanics physicists in the 1920s, said there are no, what quantum mechanics reveals is that there are no such things as things. But the Buddha, who pointed this out 2,500 years earlier, about 2,400 years earlier than Heisenberg. So, wisdom deconstructs and sees everything as just a dream. And compassion, loving kindness, deep, deep, sympathetic joy. That goes, wow, what a dream. It's like the Buddha saying in the Diamond Sutra, the Diamond Cutter Sutra, from the old Sanskrit Vajracchedika Sutra. The Buddha tells his disciples, Subhuti, O Subhuti, your role, your dharma, your way as a great bodhisattva, enlightening being, is to help enlighten all sentient beings. And then the Buddha says, and O Subhuti, you must realize there are no sentient beings. And then he tells Subhuti, and Subhuti, there are sentient beings. Please help liberate all sentient beings. My own mentor, one of my mentors, the one I was face to face with, the one who kind of delivered the final axe and annihilated any possible vestige of doubt or confusion about any kind or level of the spiritual teaching, Sri Nisargadatta, back in January 81. There had been all sorts of revelations up to that point from the time when the, you know, that first kind of opening back in 1971, a decade earlier, out in the backyard when I was 16. Sri Nisargadatta had a saying. It's printed one way in the famous collection of dialogues called I Am That, but he told us, a handful of us who were there in person with him one night, he said, wisdom says, I am nothing or nobody. Love says, I am everybody.
Yeah.
My balance, my life is a balance of the two. And so the Buddha, in the whole great tradition of Buddhism, you go, you know, in the Theravada tradition, as it's called in South Asia, the Tantric tradition that wound up in northern India and Tibet and over in Japan, Shingon Buddhism, certainly the Chan and Zen and Song traditions of Buddhism, Huayan, other schools of Buddhism, they are all rooted in this balance of wisdom and compassion. All those great tantric ceremonies, you might have seen a YouTube video of the Dalai Lama, His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, doing a high tantric ceremony, or one of the other lamas. And they have the bell and the vajra, it's hard to translate what that is, the thunderbolt implement. You know, the dance of the two hands with these two implements. It's all to suggest the dance of wisdom and compassion. No sentient beings, all sentient beings. Deconstruction and full embracing of all beings.
Yeah, the Nisargadatta quote.
We're lopsided.
I was going to say the Nisargadatta quote you just shared. You said he said it to you all, but he must have said it other times too because it's written down. It's the quote I was contemplating this morning.
Yeah. Serendipity.
Yeah.
Well, we dreamed. One reality forms all these connections.
Yes.
How are we connecting now? Any of us,
yes.
100 of us or so gathered here, we could be, I don't know, other kind of beings in some other world, I don't know, watching their version of TV or something and chilling. No, we get to be connected in this way, in this moment, this precious vanishing moment, because it is all vanishing. Buddhists in, say, insight meditation speak a lot about being aware of arising sensations, perceptions, and so forth. But they're instantly vanishing. All these worlds are instantly vanishing. There's nothing to be afraid of about that because you are the fearless, entirely whole and complete source of these formations that arise and vanish. They happen in you. as our ancient Upanishads from India say, the world arises in you, the absolute. The personal consciousness seems to be inside a body-mind. And that body-mind, with a little me, ego-G, as I like to say. Because ego is not a bad entity. We use like Baba-G or Swamiji, we say ego-G. In our satsangs over these many years, because we're not out to bust people's egos. No, there's healthy ego function, as the Western tradition of psychology would call it. The capacity to be responsible and accountable, to put off pleasure for the sake of work, as Freud called it, being able to stick with, not being a slave to your id and libido tendencies. So let there be healthy ego function, the good old ego-G. And we just leave off the unnecessary dysfunctional stuff. So ego-G, the sense of being of the personal consciousness, closely associated with a particular body-mind set of functions. And the body is not a thing, and the mind is not a thing. They're bodying and minding, they're a process. They arise moment by moment, moment by vanishing moment. The personal ego-G, personal consciousness, or soul, or jiva, as they call it in India, is empowered to be quite functional. But this ego-G and its body-mind are in the world, but the entire world, including this body-mind ego-G and all body-mind ego-Gs, all arise in this one absolute awareness, which is your absolute nature. And so in the non-dual traditions, they evolved a way of articulating truth at basically two different levels. The absolute truth level, Paramartika Satya, on the relative or conventional or pragmatic functional level, the so-called Samvriti Satya, or sometimes they had written Vyavaharika Satya, truth level. So a true sage, like Ramana Maharshi, the great wisdom sage of the first half of the 20th century in India, timeless, as we all are actually, not limited to any century, any moment of time. You're the eternal, timeless. Ramana Maharshi would often speak on the absolute level, as would my mentor Sri Nisargadatta, as any sage of the non-dual wisdom traditions, East or West. They'll say things like, none of this really exists. None of this ever really happened. What seems to be is only a seeming, a dreaming. There is only the absolute. That's an absolute level teaching. There is no right or wrong. There is no anything. There are no sentient beings. That's an absolute level teaching. Space and time do not exist. That's an absolute level teaching. But how are you doing, Regina? How's your family? Your dear friends, how are they?
Have you eaten?
That's a relative level, pragmatic level,
yeah,
kind of parlance or conversation. And it's entirely appropriate. Yes. So these characters that are going around, they learned how to speak absolutish at some point, reading a few texts, maybe just talks with Ramana Maharshi. I always encourage those people to read Day by Day with Bhagwan, another book about Ramana Maharshi that is a better window onto what it was actually like being around him on a day-to-day basis. I spent a lot of time in the first couple of trips to India, 1980-81 and 1988, meeting a lot of the old disciples of Ramana Maharshi. I had a lot of close time with Annamalai Swami, wonderful spiritual son of Ramana Maharshi. He was not, quote, a disciple. Ramana said he had no disciple. There was no lineage. So people that claim a lineage from Ramana Maharshi, they're inventing something out of their own mind to position themselves on a pedestal in a certain way. Ramana Maharshi always only saw the absolute self. But he was very appreciative of the personal consciousness self, the lower level self, so to say, the individual, unique self or person. And Annamalai Swami was like this. He could speak absolutish, or he could relate very personally, very warmly. Mentioning Annamalai Swami, I might give your listeners a marvelous definition of enlightenment for the personal consciousness. given that our real nature right now is the clear light of all lights or enlightenments. He said, when I asked him once, what's it like being free? He said, it's like zero gravity. Nothing is pulling you anymore. That's a kind of
equanimity
you were speaking earlier.
Yes, that's a good definition.
So some of these characters wandering around just priding themselves secretly, insidiously on speaking absolutish, because you can one-up anyone's position. If you tell me, Regina, you know, the weather here where you are is such and such, and what's it like out there? And I say, Regina, none of that is real. See, this is how I was speaking when I was 16.
Well,
parents thought I was on drugs because I would sometimes talk like this.
And this was because you had not yet developed a maturity within the shift?
Well, I knew it was all a big game, really, that our absolute nature is playing as this finite earth scene, you know, of Timothy with his parents and sister at the dinner table. For instance, my dad would come home from work, and, you know, my mom might say, you know, Timothy, how was school today? Mom, there's only this moment.
No wonder she thought you were on drugs.
Oh, yeah. My sister would secretly counsel them because she was the little pothead in the family smoking grass with her friends. She'd say, he's probably on something, so don't say anything that'll trigger a bum trip. It was hilarious.
Oh, your poor parents. They must have been terrified.
Very quickly, you know, really by like the second night of this, I was saying, hey, listen, relax. Nothing's wrong with your son. I've just opened up to, you know, what these sacred traditions are talking about, what we read in our catechism and hear from the Bible quoted in church on Sundays. So I would just caution those that frequent certain circles, cyberspace or in person, with certain characters. And shall I name names? I don't want to name names.
Yeah, not necessary.
There's a couple lineages in particular from two less than stellar Indian teachers of the 1980s, 90s, that have given rise to a highly imbalanced, a terribly imbalanced sense of non-duality. It does not honor what our great non-dual wisdom sages, East and West, male and female, articulated over the centuries. It's all about learning to go into a depersonalized state and then speak absolutish.
Yes.
And you'll wield a certain amount of personal power that way, because people will treat you as special, especially if you change your names and start wearing fancy Indian clothes or something. There's a lot of people for ego needs that feel the need to do that, but it's artificial. It's not natural.
Well, first of all, I wanted to share a little something about me. I had an experience in 2009 where the inner teacher took on the persona of Ramana Maharshi, and it was a very interesting experience because I didn't know Ramana Maharshi. And but what I loved about the experience was, when I knew this inner, I call it inner Ramana. When I knew this inner Ramana, I knew myself so well.
Yes.
So well. But at some point, this is what led me to start listening to non-dual teachings. Because up until this point, I hadn't. I was unaware of the word non-dual. But once this Ramana thing happened within me, that caused me to start looking in that direction. And for a time,
a beautiful direction. I mean, creme de la creme.
Well, for a time, I was listening to some of these teachers that I think you're talking about. And what happened for me, and I've talked about this here, so people are aware, although I also have not mentioned names. But what happened for me is, I call it, I was teetering on what I call false enlightenment. And what I was guided to do, the miracle was, what the guidance came, was for me to go to India for 3 weeks. And I went to Tiruvannamalai, and I spent time there, and that brought me back to center, sitting there, you know, with, of course, what I would call my guide, Ramana Maharshi, sitting there in that presence, brought me back to center, so I did not fall off that false enlightenment. But I was right there on the edge, and I know exactly the type of teaching you're talking about that has that temptation in it. So
it will make life simple for people whose lives have felt burdened by complexity, disorder, angst, and agitation and pain. There's a kind of blessed relief. It's like taking a really powerful pain pill, a narcotic. It fuzzes you out, kind of narrows your focus down to this feeble little pseudo-bliss. Everything will seem all right because you've eliminated everything else. You've desensitized. You've, in a way, depersonalized. But that's not going to serve anyone for any length of quality time. It's not going to help relationships. And really the proof of the pudding with all this is how people's relationships get transformed.
Yeah,
they
I was going to say.
Become a smug son of a bitch, lording their enlightenment over everyone else and then going around. And mind you, there's a number of people out there making big bucks.
I know.
Assuming to be enlightened, and I will enlighten you.
Well, as I was going to say, let's go back to something you just said. You said it so quickly, but sometimes when you say things quickly, people don't hear. So I'd like you to repeat yourself. you said something about that doesn't help relationships. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what would a genuine insight, you know, let's not go as far as a shift, because I feel pretty certain a person would recognize the genuine shift.
Yeah.
But let's say, you know, we're not to the point where the genuine shift has happened. How can people tell within themselves whether they're following, you know, genuine insights and a sincere inner guiding principle, or whether the head is getting involved and the head is taking shortcuts? How what are some gauges they can check within themselves?
Here's one real simple one. How much empathy is there for fellow beings when you're in their presence? And mind you, we're always in the presence of subtle plane beings. Your old Grandma Susie and Uncle Joe, who maybe a sibling, parent has passed on. So these beings are always around us. We're always in relationship on the phenomenal level. Our true nature is prior to all relation. It's the single absolute reality, and yet it plays as this field of beings and interrelationships. So the mark of this deep, truly transcendent wisdom is that you find yourself the very essence, the isness, the interiority of each and every being encountered. Now, on the personal consciousness level, say the humanist level, there will be, you know, a certain kind of distinctiveness to the me person. In the morning, say, I don't know if you're in a relationship with someone, a spouse or someone, you know, when you're standing in front of the bathroom mirror, you don't presume to start brushing that person's teeth. You let them brush their teeth, you brush your teeth, you know. So on a functional human level, there's individuation, there's distinctions, there are healthy boundaries. And that's really important, to have healthy, functional boundaries, because there are certain kind of people in their confusion, sometimes full-blown mental disorder, they invade those boundaries. They presume. They violate your space, to put it another way.
Yeah, I experienced
that.
But
on the deep level, we can have this radical empathy, the spaciousness that includes all personal spaces. We really have a sense of what it's like to be one's fellow being. One of the first things that happened to me when I was 16, you know, with my buddies, and I got to college just about a year, less than a year and a half later, in the lounge, student lounge at the dorm at UC Santa Cruz, where we were all on campus at the little University of California, Santa Cruz. I would often sit down with a person and say, let's trade viewpoints. Let's have a sense of what it's like to be the fellow person, so that right now the Regina viewpoint is being played by the Timothy viewpoint, and the Timothy viewpoint right now is being played by the Regina viewpoint. Really, there's just one reality, the one self or spirit, the suprapersonal. So your deeper empathy, feeling others' pains is your pain, their joy is your joy. The Buddha recommended this quality of sympathetic joy, so that subtle, insidious qualities of envy or jealousy are precluded, they're nipped in the bud. And yet the wisdom, the transcending deconstructive wisdom, this will keep you from being just totally caught up in the anguish of beings that are in anguish, the mindless giddy euphoria of those that are stuck in those, you know, party person states. So you're free, and yet you're participating. I've sometimes put this to people who come to our free Tuesday night satsangs and other events over the years. You're totally uninvolved while being completely involved. Totally unengaged, transcendent, infinite, while being very engaged with the finite processes, the feelings, and perceptions of fellow beings. So this, I would say, first off, is a crucial quality of enlightened, truly enlightened spirituality. Coming from your clear light nature, ever free, and freely participating in the incredibly poignant drama of fellow sentient beings who are dealing with all sorts of things like fears and sense of grieving losses and anticipating with hope certain beneficent changes and developments in their life.
There you are. I've been swiping back and forth, and every time I've come over here, you know, there's just been a black screen and audio, and this time I swipe back and there you are. You've turned on your video camera.
Well, for that particular moment where I was talking about the Regina viewpoint, Smithy viewpoint, or any of the, your guests, that you're, I don't know if you can see the dozens of people, dear.
Oh, I can't see them, but I can see their names, and many, many of them I've met. So what I do is I do scan their names, and in that way I connect with them. And, yeah. Well, listen, and in fact, one of the people in the room, and I don't think he's the only one. He's just the one that's actively looking at it the most right now. So he's talking about it a lot. But he has a lot of self-judgment and a lot of belief in his own, you know, what you would call the I am bad thought or guilt or unworthiness. And is there anything you can say to him or others who are really stuck with that right now?
And let me just preface it by saying Timothy can say all sorts of verbiage. The real awakening is prior to all words, beyond all words, when you stand in your true nature, what you always already are, in your deepest, most natural, original beingness. So, self-judgment. Let me say that, you know, people with a lot of self-judgments are often the most conscientious. And so, it's the sons of guns that have no developed conscience, the sociopaths, and unfortunately a lot of this neo or pseudo Advaita non-duality that teaches depersonalization, it can turn you into a careless, you know, literally uncaring sociopath. So I'm always happy to hear about really conscientious people. It gives me a sense that there's a sincerity there. And I've often shared with people just two basic qualities, sincerity and curiosity, will complete this whole path of spiritual cultivation and also the sudden enlightenment to what we intrinsically are. The curiosity will turn into real wisdom, and the sincerity will turn into that deep, all-embracing compassion and loving kindness, including for the personal consciousness, so that a moment of self-evaluation or judgment may come up. Like, you know, if I say something to my wife or to Regina or to anyone, you know, it might be kind of off, and the Timothy consciousness will hear it and go, oh, well, that wasn't quite right. I might have insulted, you know, a person. So that's a kind of an evaluative, very useful, functional kind of program. And it might lead to, quote, a self-judgment. I just said something very insulting to that person, you know. For shame. But in the next moment, it can be released.
Yes.
Because if we just carry it around, if we live inside it, if we define ourselves by it, we're simply creating a thought form and trying to live in that thought form when our true liveliness, the aliveness, is prior to all this. So notice one thing, too, that self-judgments come up twofold from our nurturing, that is our parenting, social group, and from our biology, psychobiology. I'll speak about the latter first. Associated with this human form, these human beings, Homo sapiens, are primates. Primates are tribal. They form little groups of, you know, several to maybe a dozen or two or three at most, three dozen members. And there's intense belonging needs. And so whenever one does something that triggers disgust, revulsion, disapproval from the group, there's always a deep-seated programmed fear, and it's there for a good reason, that will be ostracized, will be kicked out, exiled, left behind by the tribe. And so a lot of the psyche has been working for millions of years of primate evolution to ensure that we will judge ourselves in ways to shape ourselves up so that we'll be acceptable members of the tribe. And when stuff happens where that gets kind of triggered at deep levels, natural fears and self-judgments will come up. The self-judgment is our psychobiology's way of preempting other people's judgments of us. And it's how we say, oh, I'm sorry, and oh, I didn't mean to do that, and oh, shame on me, forgive me, you know, keep me in the tribe. I'm speaking rudimentarily about this, but this is how it works on a deep psychobiological level, going back millions of years of primate evolution. Now, more immediately on the personal level, it can happen that, you know, little Johnny or Susie, what's the name of our conversation partner here?
His name is David, and he's the one I told you is 18, so you can imagine he must be very sincere to even be here with all us old people.
Well, you know, Regina referred to you as the youngest one, but who knows, 19 years ago, you may be coming off an incarnation as a 98-year-old Zen master, so you're older than any of us here. David, I would say that, you know, it often happens in the raising of a child, the David child, the Regina or Timothy child, that a parent or an uncle, or maybe if you have an older sibling, might have yelled at you one day in an emotionally charged situation, like you broke a vase or, I don't know, slapped your baby sister. I'm not going to presume to know what went on in your life, but it might happen that a parent and grandparent and uncle or older sibling yells at you and says, you're bad. Oh, you're so bad. You did something very, very wrong. Often little infants, especially by the time of toddler age, when they're running around breaking things and messing with things, they hear that message a lot. You're bad. You did something wrong. You just made a giant mistake. And so the very sincere psyche, which is absorbing all these learnings, you know, countless thousands of learnings every day in the child of a young organism, it takes on in the subconscious a model, a program, I am bad. Even I am evil. There's some households, unfortunately, where children are raised with the idea that what you just did was actually evil, was terribly sinful. And they invoke God's name and scriptural citations, and they basically use God as a concept to beat the shit out of you. Excuse my French. Merde, en français. And so from our own evolutionary psychobiology, and then from our specific individual context in the family system growing up with parents that might have played out more of that critical parent kind of role than the more nurturing parent. One can be saddled on a subconscious level, and then it comes up into the preconscious and conscious levels. Terrible self-judgments. All I'm saying is that all of this is a natural process. The personal consciousness will have certain foibles and flaws because it's not the perfect divine absolute source of all the worlds.
Let it be. There can be an at ease, letting go, trusting that the body, mind, ego, G can become more and more functional, more and more helpful, make fewer mistakes. David, whatever your name is on your transpersonal level, as the soul emanated by God that's worn different bodies over the eons, you know, what you are is the absolute, the superpersonal. You've taken on a David incarnation, a lifetime, and it's at this point only 18 trips around the sun, only 18 years old. So there's still lots of learnings to happen. Areas of the brain haven't even fully developed. We know from neuroscience, things like risk assessment and so forth haven't even fully developed until the early 20s, usually. So the David character, the life, and the absolute self nature that you are, is going to play out certain adventures of learning. Some will be very pleasant, beautiful, pleasurable. Others may not seem to be that, may seem to be more of the opposite. And I would simply invite that the self-judgments are a process of your own sincerity. There's an aspect of you that wants to play this drama well, play the actor's gig on the stage beautifully, and, quote, not make mistakes. At a certain point, you're at ease about that. And whether mistakes get made, it's like a slapstick comedy. Sometimes you'll fall flat on your face, you know, sliding on the banana peel, like the old slapstick comedies from the early movies. And that's fine. Your true nature will be so inclusive that you'll be able to be conscientious, accountable, and responsible, able to respond as well as you can to situations, relationships. And then this other aspect of you will be able to laugh it all off. And sometimes, you know, if you like offend someone in an interpersonal situation, while realizing that it's all open, clear, ever free, you will be able to do things like make amends, be able to say, I'm sorry. Teach me how to honor your needs better. In other words, you'll learn the processes of relationship, intercommunication, in a humble, sincere way, without arrogance, without always, you know, covering your ass, trying to seem, you know, perfect and flawless, which is just a posture and it's inauthentic. You'll be very amenable to learning, growing, developing. You'll be open to being taught by everyone. Everyone can be your teacher in that situation. How to be a better David, a David that serves other beings better. And you'll stand free in your super-personal nature, invincible. So you're not just kowtowing to everyone and needy and, you know, kind of always clinging to other people's opinion of you. You do become autonomous. In psychology, you would have what we call an internal locus of control. You're not always kind of checking to see how others feel about you, think about you, judge you. And then measuring your worth in those terms. You'll be able to, in other words, to walk or march, as they say, to the beat of your own drummer. Well, these are all cliches that we have in society that you've probably heard. So the self-judgments are useful forms of self-evaluation, yet we need not be stuck in them in a heavy way. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I think,
David,
that was beautiful for David. David, yeah, he said, I appreciate this response very much. I know David pretty well, so as I was listening, I could almost understand how he might be hearing you. And I knew it was a good answer, but yes, he also is saying. And now, I had told you we would go until the half hour, which is only 5 minutes away, but but if you want to stay longer, we can do that too. That is perfectly up to you. Pardon?
Yes.
You are willing to stay. Okay, yeah. Well, then I'm going to swipe away from you. I feel funnier leaving you now that I can see your face. But, okay, now I'm not looking at you, and I'm looking at everyone else. And my question now is, does anybody else have a question that you would like to ask Timothy at this point? If not, I can continue to ask questions. But you know, his response to David was wonderful. So if somebody else has a question that feels more personal that you would like to ask, feel free. And I'm just waiting for a moment because it may take them a moment if they're trying to type it, or they could raise their hand and take the mic.
Can you hear me, Regina, when you're in the other system?
Yes, I can. In fact, I've been going back and forth the whole time, and I don't think you're even aware of it. I think you see me as if I'm looking at you the whole time, but I'm not, because sometimes I'm looking at them. It's like I'm running back
you're
and forth.
Through this ephemeral Timothy form to the internet.
Yes, yes.
I was simply going to say, while people might be mustering questions or sharings or complaints, for David's question, you know, on the simplest level, any self-judgment is simply a thought. It's a perception. We are always the host. The ever-free openness of awareness in which everything arises. Energies, sensations, perceptions, including self-judgment, emotional reactions like sense of shame or guilt, and the sense of the personal consciousness. All of that arises in what we always already are, fundamentally now, here, closer than close, our true nature.
Okay,
so
we
simply
are...
see off those things. Yep. We make use of them and see them off. And we're free. It's like lines drawn in water, said the Buddha. The reactions of sages are like lines drawn in water. They're there, but gone the next moment.
That is beautiful. In fact, I personally have not been angry for a number of years, but in the last couple of months I did get angry at someone, and what
No.
I was gonna say I was actually quite thrilled with it, because what happened was I noticed the anger came up, and I was very angry for the time that the interaction occurred, a couple of minutes. But then the second the couple of minutes was over, it was so entirely dropped that was actually a pleasure to see, because when I used to get angry, I would get angry and hold on to it. And then I learned to watch my mind, watch the key thoughts that I was reacting to, and learn to let go of those thoughts. And then I had a long period of not experiencing anger. So then when I experienced anger and saw it was very raw, and you could call it very real in the moment, but then it was over.
Yeah. That's the nature of the play, the divine play, the infinite pretending to be finite, the vividness.
Yes.
The body sensations, the vividness of the mental emotional formations, they seem so real. And yet, in the next moment, they're entirely gone.
Yeah.
It might seem like there's a pattern, like the anger might last, you know, 17 seconds or 17 minutes.
Yeah.
You know. But actually, in each moment, it's disappearing.
Yes.
Yielding a new moment for the universe.
Well, that's exactly what I experienced, and it was so complete that it was actually fun. I had no shame. That doesn't mean I didn't also look, though, at what made me angry, so next time the same scenario would not trigger me again. But there was no shame, no guilt, and well, we do have questions now, so let's get off of me. And I'm going to turn the mic over first to Jay, and so you'll hear Jay speak, and then I will let you know when we take the mic back, because if we don't have the mic, they won't hear you anyway. All right? So, Jay, I'm turning the mic over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Regina. Yeah, it was great to hear you talk, Timothy, and hear your voice and receive your teachings. I heard you mention about, sort of make a reference to reincarnation in a sense, and I guess I, at this point, think of it as more, not so much as an absolute truth, maybe as what I could call a relative truth, or something that seems to be in our reality. Do you have any thoughts, or what are your thoughts on that relative truth of reincarnation, or the seeming reality of reincarnation?
Okay. One moment, I'll tell you when I have the mic again. All right, Timothy, you may speak.
Julie, don't ask about Timothy's thoughts, because it can trigger avalanches of thoughts. You're entirely correct. The whole phenomenon or set of phenomena that we loosely term reincarnation, rebirth, is entirely phenomenal. It's relative. It's not absolute. But in the realm of empirical experiencing, rebirth feels very vivid. It feels like an actual happening in the play of personal consciousness and its experiences and relationships. So I'm not sure how much more you need to know about that other than, there's a massive body of literature from regression therapists and people like Professor Ian Stevenson and his colleagues around the world that went and recorded and documented the cases of little children remembering prior lifetimes, and then they actually went and met the prior embodiments' relations, their family, their village or city, and documenting all this. So Robert Almeter, professor of philosophy, who is probably professor emeritus at this point, he was editor-in-chief of the American Philosophical Quarterly, one of our most prestigious academic philosophy journals. He looked at the literature just around the Ian Stevenson and his colleagues' work on children remembering past lives, and especially when there would be like birthmarks that seemed to reflect somehow the wound that did him off in the previous lifetime. This professor, Robert Almeter, looked at Stevenson and others' work and said the evidence is so robust, the data is so robust, the evidence is so clear, that the burden of disproof is now on the skeptics to come up with a better hypothesis to account for all the data than the reincarnationalist hypothesis. So there's loads and loads and loads of data out there. And again, people through spontaneous memories or the Netherton method, which is a form of body work that opens up past life sequences, especially those associated with a certain emotional charge, like feeling unloved or feeling full of fear or full of certain kind of desires, certain addictions. All of this stuff can emerge. And it can also come through hypnotherapy, having a past life regression session. And some of these people, I'm forgetting some of the names, Helen Wambach and others, they used to do mass hypnotic regression to prior lives with big groups and auditoriums and so forth. So like 1,000 people at once would experience a past life or two. So, and these feel like our memories, in terms of the personal consciousness. It doesn't feel like a story. It feels like a memory. It has all the qualities of a personal memory for the personal consciousness, or the jiva, as they call it in ancient India. So, phenomenally, on the level of phenomena, empirical experiencing, the relative or conventional, functional or dysfunctional level, yeah, reincarnation or rebirth is relatively true. Absolutely, it's not true. Our true nature is, as the Buddha said, as we know intuitively in all clarity, as open awareness, we are the unborn, the unbecome, the uncompounded, the unmade. That's which is prior to all dimensions of space-time, including psychic or psychological space-time, which is how rebirth occurs. And rebirth is, in fact, happening each moment. The Tibetan Books of the Dead, there was actually a few or several of them, the Bardo Thodols, it wasn't just one of them. But they all have the same perspective and same teaching, which is that moment of experiencing the clear light with the dropping of the physical body is actually happening each moment. We simply don't recognize this fact. So, Jay, you are host as the absolute to a whole series of lifetimes, past, present, future, and they've gone by different names. They're not always named Jay. You might be named Jay Dean or whatever it might be. Chinese bodies, Vietnamese bodies, Tibetan bodies, Egyptian bodies, North American, Central, South American bodies, maybe bodies of subtle plane beings in other realms. You have been host to this incredible melodrama, adventure in consciousness. And there's a personal consciousness interacting with fellow personal consciousnesses, and the personal consciousness associate with body-mind apparati, functional instruments, these bodyings, these mindings, these active processes of physicality and you know, sensory, perceptual, emotional, self-identification kind of trips. So these are all happening in you, the great host. In Zen language, all of these phenomena, these lifetimes, are guests. The personal consciousness that's presently known as Jay is a guest, a mere phenomenon, a passing phenomenon. And what you, O nameless one, O original one, always are, what you are right now, fundamentally. Have you not noticed, too, that the body-mind-ego-G, J-G, Honorable J, all of that disappears in deep dreamless sleep? There's a complete death. You utterly let everything go. No more emails, no more Skyping or pal talk, no more relations, no more body, no more mind, no world. You abide as open awareness. So all these lifetimes, just like, you know, the dream state and so-called waking state of the physical environment reappearing, are rebirths. But you're actually not inside the birth process. You are the unborn. Birth happens in you, O unborn one. My favorite Zen master of all time, Zen master Benkei from the 17th century, he cut through all the nonsense, whether it was Rinzai tradition or Soto Zen tradition nonsense, and he just taught one simple teaching. Don't identify with the born. Don't get born, he would say. An alcoholic would come, complain about their alcoholism. You go, all right, these are personal tendencies. Don't get born as that. You were always prior to that. You're always the ever-free awareness, the Buddha nature. A woman came, complained, you know, oh, the Buddhist teaching, some of the literature anyway, says I have to have a male embodiment in order to realize the supreme enlightenment. He'd say, whenever did you really get born as a woman? You are the gender-free absolute. The true nature, the Buddha nature. Infinite awareness. Isness.
Isness. That's my favorite word. In fact, they've been teasing me lately, talking about me, saying isness is my business. But
it's not busy. Except insofar as you're somehow host for this incredible intelligence that can grow hair and smile and nod your head right now and generate countless gazillion proteins, enzymes, cellular metabolism.
Yes.
That seems like busyness, but it's actually at ease and ever-free process emanating from our formless nature.
Well, I mentioned that I teach the hour before this, so I was just speaking before you came, and I gave a long list of things that people know I have done, and I said, but I never had a sense that I did any of it, and that's, you know, none of it came from me, so,
right. Yes. That's that transcending of the sense of doership, that's the cardinal teaching of Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, well, my experience is a little strange because some of this transcendence came before others. Like there, once the spiritual path starting, I didn't feel like I did that. So everything that has to do with the spiritual path, on the one hand, I've done lots of things, it appears, like writing books and starting a church, but none of those things I feel like I've done. Where there has been some personal involvement has been in the letting go of clinging to values, beliefs, those assigned tasks of watching this mind and waking up here, I have done. But the outer stuff that people know me for, I have not done. So it's interesting.
But, yeah, the super-personal nature uses the inert, insentient personal consciousness to achieve various ends, various functions.
Yeah.
And sometimes the process will feel intensely personal and emotionally charged and kind of mucky and confused. And that's just part of the divine play.
Yeah.
The divine plays it not being divine. Our godliness plays it ungodly hell. Our wholeness, true divine holiness, plays it unholy madness sometimes. And that's just part of the big slapstick divine comedy.
Well, we have another question. Why don't we go to
sure.
it? Let's see. Hold on. People can write questions as well. And this one
sure.
was written and it scrolled off the board. So let me scroll back up to it. Let's see. Where did it go? Here it is. Okay. This is from someone named Jolie. On the way to being awakened is we need do nothing appropriate. So the statement, we need do nothing. How does that fit with the process of awakening? Do you need more?
You are the wayless way.
The wayless way.
There is no destination for who you are, or one alone. As for the apparent doing and efforting on the way, it's like taking a hike. Certain energy and effort seems to be required and expended. But what is the source of that energy and effort? Is it from the Jolie consciousness? Or does it somehow just happen and it makes use of the Jolie limited identity to accomplish all sorts of efforts? And I don't know if you go on long hikes or any kind of like marathon sports or anything, or just, hard work, working a 9-to-5. Or many Americans now, with the radically fast, rapid disappearing of our middle class, many people are working 2 or 3 jobs. So it needs to go on long hikes or pilgrimages or engage in ascetic practices, daily life and work, and being a responsible being. Is asceticism enough? It's life in an ashram, I can tell you, is quite easy compared to the daily rigors of just keeping body, soul together, paying bills, caring for family or loved ones. So that will require massive energies and effort. In other words, you're not just sitting on your butt all day. But what is the reality of that energy and effort? My mentor, Sri Nisargadatta, gave a very fascinating contemplation. The people that have made kind of a cottage industry out of selling merchandise in the name of Nisargadatta have completely missed this. But he spelled it out for a naturopath doctor in the summer of 1980, 14, 15 months before he dropped the body, this great sage Nisargadatta. And he had said it prior to this, but it was in this set of conversations with this naturopath doctor who was visiting from Northern California. Nisargadatta made this just a very clear teaching. In other words, most people know the Nisargadatta teaching, like most of the Ramana Maharshi teaching, to be kind of who am I or what am I, and it's a cognitive process of kind of pulling back from thoughts, perceptions, emotions, identity, narrow limited identity into this open vastness. It's a cognitive, intuitive process. Nisargadatta introduced an alternative practice, and it's the meditation or contemplation of the vital power, the energy. I started off this conversation tonight talking in these terms. This shapeless, colorless power that's doing everything in your life. So, Jolie, if you lift a finger, what's the power by which you do that? What's the power by which you comprehend language right now? It's this shapeless, colorless, invisible power. It's power that's doing everything and being everyone. So, Sri Nisargadatta said, meditate on this. Get to know this. Become friends with this. Get deeply, deeply acquainted with this power. You can't make an object out of it, and yet it's so obviously the reality that's doing everything. This, he said, is the God of your life, without which the Jolie body is a little fertilized cell in mama's womb, never would have grown into a baby or a toddler or an adolescent. This is the power that's allowing you to comprehend and use language. operate a computer. So Srinivasagadatta said, meditate on this power. Deeply, deeply know this power. And then finally he said, you be this power. This power is who you truly are. You be this. So he said, whether you come back through this cognitive process of what am I pulling back from thoughts, or whether you just be this vital power, you'll, in either case, awaken to your absolute nature, the source of this power, the source of the cognitive, intuitive ability to know that we are. So I would say that this meditation on the vital power that Srinivasagadatta shared with us is extremely useful for householders who have to be busy often from morning till night. They can't have the luxury to go off to, you know, some paid retreat for a month or 6 months or 5 years. It's just not in their vocation, their swadharma, as Krishna says in the Gita, to be a monastic type, a hermit, a reclusive contemplative. No, they're very involved with relationship, with work, play, creativity, maybe important political work or activism, engagement on behalf of social justice, gender justice, environmental justice. For such persons, very active, the pure contemplation in a cognitive way on what we are will seem maybe kind of sterile. It's something you might only be able to think about a few times a day, so to say. But this meditation on the power that's doing this life, all this responding, all this functioning, that can happen in any posture, any position, whether alone or with people, on a freeway, in a car, at a computer. And so let this power unfold all the spiritual unfolding, all the cultivation of the virtues and qualities, you know, the loving kindness, the compassion, the sympathetic joy, the qualities of generosity, patience, strength, fearlessness, goodness. Let all of this flow by the great energy and effort of the one alone who makes all energies and efforts possible, the vital power, the divine power, the Shakti, as it's also called in India, prana. In the Far East, they call this chi or ki energy, mana energy among the Polynesians, the power of the Holy Spirit, as they call it in Christian tradition, barga in the Sufi traditions, so forth. You are the absolute, the source of all worlds, beings, happenings and activities. You are the source of the energies and efforts that arise. Let those energies and efforts sometimes be strenuous and charged and magnificent in their power and scope. But don't get confused what the source of the power is, and you're ever free. You're always at home.
You mentioned earlier two qualities that you thought were very helpful, sincerity and curiosity. And and I must say, I feel the same way. And the curiosity, the way the curiosity has helped me was to watch rather than participate. Even though I appear to still be moving around and doing things, I feel like I'm always watching. I don't even know what I will say next. Like I told you, I didn't prepare for this at all. Everything's spontaneous. It sounds to me as you're speaking that one thing that might be helpful for people if they haven't yet is to learn that quality of watching, maybe through curiosity, so they don't have such a strong sense of doing and making decisions.
Right. Yeah, that's basic mindfulness or witnessing function, as the Hindus called it. The Buddhists call it mindfulness. It's Christ and Jesus the Christ in the Gospels talking about watchfulness. But it doesn't need to be a rigid, uptight watchfulness. There's some people adopt vipassana, sati vipassana, Buddhist mindfulness, or Hindu witnessing techniques, and they get too yogic with it, too uptight. They get worried that they're not always in wholesome states. Well, say suddenly there was an earthquake in your community. I say that because I live in California. Live in places like maybe it might be a bad, you know, hurricane or a fire or something. I will almost guarantee there won't be perfectly placid nervous system activity ruled by the parasympathetic side of your nervous system. No, I can almost guarantee that cortisol and adrenaline will rush as you mobilize to save loved ones, pets, help members in your community, work actively to clear rubble. That'll be a very energetic and engaged process of doing, but it'll be the power that's doing everything. And it won't feel placid and peaceful like when your parasympathetic nervous system is dominating in sleep or a deep state of relaxation, say in meditation, seated meditation, or having a massage. There is freedom, there is clarity, but it's host for a whole different kind of functioning for the body, mind, me-ji, the me, the person.
Me-ji.
Yeah, person-ji, ego-ji, I love these terms.
The me-ji.
Because each personal consciousness is so adorable.
That's the sweetness I heard in you.
The invisible God has become worshipable, adorable, as this particularly precious, poignant, unduplicatable, non-replicable personal consciousness.
Yeah, that's what I felt in you, and I have felt it in a few others as well when I, you know, contact them through the matter of my job. Every now and I get this sense that even though this person has no idea who I am on a personal level, I get this sense that I am immediately personally a matter. There's a connection there, even though we've never met. You have no idea who Regina Don Akers is. And because that's how I feel about people, whether I know them or not. I recognize it when it comes to me from someone else, and I value that. That seems to recognize the connection that's there. it just seems pure.
Yeah, love is the dynamic aspect of our nature.
Yeah.
It's power that plays as all beings and worlds and activities is absolutely suffused with, charged with love, loving kindness, compassion, that deep empathy, and great, great joy, just in the delight of being one another.
And yet I would imagine there must be a time when you notice firmness come through you. Is that true?
Of course.
Okay, and
healthy boundaries, as I said. You know, Nazis are pulling your family members out and shooting them. You know, yeah, on one level, the absolute level, you know there's only the absolute awareness. I actually inserted a second level. It's why I teach a threefold level model of truth. One is absolutely true, the other two are relatively true. There's an intermediate level where we see that whatever happens in the realms of the worlds and the beings and everything, it's all just pure souls. It's the sense of everything that happens is perfect. It's meant to happen, otherwise something else would be happening. But on level three, ground floor level, if you will, the level of pragmatic, everyday functioning, and relationships in this particular world, there is right and wrong. There's appropriate and inappropriate. There's skillful and unskillful. There's the wholesome and unwholesome, the beautiful and the really nasty and gnarly. So if people are like committing atrocities in your community or in a neighboring country, one's heart is moved by this. Other beings' pain feels like your pain. And so the confusion of the beings that appear to be, you know, the bad guys, the perpetrators of the injustice, there's a deep sense of, you know, may they be healed, may they be whole in their intrinsic wholeness and holiness, their divine nature. They don't need to behave like this. It's a spontaneous prayerfulness within this non-dual domain. There's a kind of healthy dualistic functioning, just like your immune system works on a dualistic level. It identifies certain cells as pathogens, immobilizes them, surrounds them, destroys them, flushes them out with the power of the lymphatic system. And other cells and tissues in your body, your immune system treats as friendly. So also there's distinctions, evaluations, so-called judgments to be made. Jesus taught, judge not, lest ye be judged. Yeah, he threw the money lenders out of the temple, and he had some very strong words. He had a sense of what healthy boundaries are. And so I think it's especially useful for women because we know just the biology, the psychobiology of the species. Men take the initiative sexually with the female, and females have to have a healthy sense of boundary. Some of these guys go on spiritual retreats just looking for women to hit on because they know women will be real open and mellow, and the particular event taught them no boundaries, you know, openness, we're all one.
Yeah.
And then some guy exploits that because he wants oneness in the form of, you know, bedding down that woman that night. And so, you know, his ancient biological urges interfere with an absolute level teaching that we're all just this one reality.
Yeah.
So it behooves the woman. It serves the woman to have a healthy boundary and know when a guy is getting kind of aggressive, when his neediness is not spiritual. And this can happen in any domain, whether, you know, business or friendship relationships. There's a respect for healthy boundaries.
Well, I had a beloved stalker once, and it was a 4-year experience, and I learned an awful lot through that experience. And in the end, what I felt was absolute love for him. And yes. I knew not to answer the phone or respond to his emails. You know,
nice.
I knew exactly. I learned that in trying to be nice and spiritual, I was actually feeding something that was very unhealthy. I was playing ping pong with him, I say. So I had to put my paddle down and step out of the game. And that's when everything in me around it began to transform. And I did end up, he would call, we would hear his name on the caller ID, and I would feel love and not answer the phone. You know, it was very
and so
wonderful.
We can look at that on the three levels that I like to help people. This three-level model will allow for real balance and wholeness, holiness. Level three, there's a stalker. It's inappropriate behavior.
Yes.
Actually, you'd have every right, you know, legally to get a restraining order. And we have law enforcement officers to help with that process and courts and so forth. So that would be a level three phenomenon of rectifying an injustice with justice. And in this case, you didn't go the legal route. You simply don't need to answer those emails or phone calls. So on level three, there's a healthy boundary, allowing your space not to be invaded by this person. Level two would be, you are twin souls among gazillions of souls, pure love emanations out of the heart and source of love, the superpersonal divine, as persons, as souls. You are beautiful, resplendent with incredible divine virtues insofar as persons can be suffused with, endowed with different beautiful divine virtues of love and kindness, friendliness, joy, beauty, creativity. That's what you are on level two, this level that's all perfect. It's kind of like a heavenly scape, a landscape of the heavens where all souls are purified. They're pure from their origins, their emanation point. And we're all together just totally made of each other's bliss and love and heartiness. It's all felt in such a heartful way. The level one teaching, which is the absolute level, beyond relativity, beyond multiplicity, is there's only this one reality prior to the worlds,
right?
Things, heavens, earths.
Well, you know, one thing, one feeling.
These are simultaneously all true.
Yes, yes. One feeling I always get.
All three levels.
One feeling I get as I listen to you and is the word that keeps coming up, and it's a word you actually used a moment ago, is the word healthy. I feel healthy spirituality coming through you, balanced spirituality coming through you, and I really value that because I do know that there is some imbalanced spiritual teachings about. And in fact, I think it's really helpful to bring several spiritual teachings together because sometimes that's where you get the balance. If you stay with just one, it can get very imbalanced in that direction. We are about out of time now, so what I'm going to do in the room, Lynn, I'm going to turn the mic over to you for a few moments so that I can say goodbye to Timothy, and then when I'm ready to take the mic again, I'll raise my hand. It's actually time for me to come back as the speaker on a different topic. We have a daily contemplation, And it's a quote every day, and we're going to discuss it. Today's quote is from Sri Sankara. So long as even a dreamlike awareness of yourself as an individual in the world remains, a wise person persistently sees to the removal of all ideas of additions to your true self. So we're going to spend the next half hour looking at what came up for people as they contemplated our daily quote today. So let me turn the mic over to Lynn. Would you like to say goodbye to everyone, Timothy, before I let go of the
mic? And again, realize as Sri Shankara, Adi Shankaracharya, the teacher of all those in the Shankara lineage, as he said about 1,300 years ago in India, you know, our true nature is this single, absolute, super-personal self, prior to all the worlds. It includes all these selves and thoughts about selves, but none of these thoughts are truly real. So that quote is a very absolute level teaching about what we are as the transcendence. Just know that our transcendence freely includes all these adorable personjis, and the whole process of energy, sensation, perception, and limited identification. All of that plays as a beautiful dream play in you, the awake, ever awake source of the dream. We are each other. We'll be seeing each other, hearing, feeling, touching, knowing each other in this great cosmic adventure. So there's really never any goodbye. We are what we are.
Well, and again,
this
group gets the opportunity to, I'm hearing my echo for the first time. This group gets the opportunity to meet with you in September if they choose to in Santa Barbara, and I'm looking for it. But I'm getting an echo now, which I think means it is time for me to turn over the mic. So let me do that. I'll be right back with you, Timothy. Lynn? I have a question. They want to know if you do coaching via Skype with anyone. Do you ever do personal coaching or no?
Yes. Since I put that website up finally around 2006, people write email and they want a Skype call from all over the world. Because I charge no money for any of this and never charge a dime, can get, in terms of healthy boundaries, a bit overwhelming since I have a wife and community here and so, and work, so-called work out of writing and so forth. So, and counseling sessions here. So I can take a certain amount of that. I prefer when people have just a really deep, sincere question that needs clearing. At the website, enlightenedspirituality.org, and again, there's a little hyphen or dash between enlightened and spirituality. There's so much material up there that I often say, you know, just read a few of the basic essays, for instance, in the non-dual spirituality section, and most doubts and confusions will be cleared just reading that stuff. So that's the first step. And then I'm happy if there's still some burning question, confusion, whatever, I'm happy to deal with that. And email works pretty well because people can formulate their questions and maybe tell a bit of their story in a succinct way. So it saves us both time, this precious commodity and our timeless infinitude. And then I can usually respond pretty quickly to the point and then freeze it up for, you know, all the other people that are writing in to be able to be of help or service in some way.
I've learned all of those same boundaries. I've learned that if you get on the phone with someone, they'll take an hour. If they send you an email, it might take 5 minutes. So.
Well, it's often more the case that I simply fall so in love with whoever is calling, male, female, old or young, that I don't want to get off the phone.
Yeah, but as you mentioned, time is a precious commodity if you have other things to do as well. So, well, let me turn the mic over to Lynn. Lynn, I'm going to turn the mic over to you just to play a song, or if you want, you could start the daily quote contemplation, whatever you feel to do, and I'll put up my hand when I'm done with Timothy, and I'll be right back.